Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A recent report by Fidelity Investments found that the number of Americans on track to retire jumped from 38% to 45% in 2015. If you are among them and financially prepared, that's great news, but many Americans still find their finances not quite in sync with their time of life. Personal finance journalist Jane Bryant Quinn has written a new book for anyone nearing or in retirement. The book is entitled How to Make Your Money Last, The Indispensable Retirement Guide. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hello, and I'm delighted to be with you.
I saw a headline in the New York Times on this topic. It said, how should you manage your money and keep it short?
That's right.
It made me laugh because that's really what this is all about for so many people, just taking the time that they don't want to. What have you learned about people's aversion to financial planning?
Well, a lot of people just think, first, as far as retirement planning is concerned, they know they ought to do it, but they don't get serious about it until they reach probably their 50s very often, because they have so many other things on their minds. They just say, I'll worry about that tomorrow. A lot of women say, oh, well, I'm terrible at math, which, of course, has nothing to do with financial planning, because I am actually terrible at math myself. Financial planning has to do with just common sense and looking ahead, and you don't need to be an arithmetic genius to do that.
And these can just as easily be people, these people with this aversion who are, you know, doing all the retirement accounts, have pensions coming in, have been working their whole lives, and maybe have two big, you know, Social Security pots to collect from, and they're still averse. You mentioned something I thought was interesting. A lot of people think they're poorer than they are.
When you start making these kinds of projections that you have to make, when you're thinking about retirement and you're asking, can I afford to retire? Or if you're in retirement, you say, oh my God, am I going to outlive my money? That's when you start making projections of what kind of income you can expect going forward and what your current expenses are and what that looks like. And a surprising number of people actually look at it, and they're mostly people with pensions, I should warn, good old-fashioned pensions. Mm-hmm. They look at it and they say, you know, I'm going to be okay. I'm going to have the money to live the way I'm living now. Maybe I'll have to cut a little here or there, but I actually don't have to worry about it, at least for a while, and I'll put it aside and I'll worry again 10 years from now. But then many people, and I would say it is more common, that people find a gap between their expected income and their likely retirement expenses, and that's when they have to start jiggling the numbers and see what they should do about it.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about personal finance in your retirement years. My guest is Jane Bryant Quinn, of course, the very well-known personal finance journalist. Her new book is entitled How to Make Your Money Last, The Indispensable Retirement Guide. If you have a question or comment for Jane Bryant Quinn, now's your chance, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The title of the book says it all, Jane. It says How to Make Your Money Last, and that's a bigger issue than ever before because we're living longer and healthier.
Living longer and probably your listeners in particular, people who probably they've had some education, they've had health insurance all their lives, these people are more likely than others to outlive their official life expectancies. And so when you look at what life expectancy is, 86, 87, 85, depending on how they count it, you should always add a few years, because people who have good, healthy backgrounds and have a better education have been shown to be the ones who are living longer. And so if you haven't saved enough money, or you don't think you've saved enough money, you just need to sit down and figure out, okay, how am I going to live, let's say, 30 years? And I've got Social Security, maybe I have a pension, maybe I have a rental property, I don't know. And then I've got X amount of savings. How do I parse that out to last for 30 years? And, you know, and there are recipes for doing that. A tremendous amount of research is being done in this field so that you can answer that question, not for people in general, but for you personally, based on your personal situation.
this generation that's retiring now still does have that very traditional pension option often. Not universally, of course, but often. That might not be the case in even 30 years.
That might not be the case in 10 years.
Okay.
But you're quite right about that. But one thing about people having pensions is that very often a couple will sort of look at the pension. And, of course, you can get it in two ways. You get a single life pension, which is a bigger check, but then when you die, it's gone. Or you get a joint life pension, which covers you and a spouse. And if you die, it's a smaller check. But if you die, your spouse has that income for the rest of his or her life. I have seen over and over again couples together making the decision, single life pension, because they're just retiring, they're worried about how far their money will stretch, and they say, we're going to take the single life pension because it's a bigger check. 5-7 years along, they really, really regret that, because first, they see they're doing okay, and second, they realize that if the pension holder dies, the spouse could be up a creek. And so if you are in this position looking at these options, unless you've married a millionaire, please, please, please protect your spouse.
And these are all questions that come through when you sit down and plug in the factors and any number of formulas or equations.
Well, I'm not sure that takes a formula or equation.
Okay.
That one takes.
But as far as knowing what you need,
your spouse or not,
yeah.
You know, this is you're doing like ordinary budgeting, except you're projecting for the future, and you're saying, what if I took a single life pension and I died tomorrow? And say you're the man and you have a dependent spouse. If I died tomorrow, would my spouse be okay? And when we talk about this projecting your income, I call it right-sizing your life, finding out how much you're going to have, how much you're going to spend, how you're going to deal with that. A married couple needs to do it three ways. You do it first if you're both a very long-lived couple and you've got everything coming in, pension, 2 Social Security checks. You do it second if say, the husband dies first and 1 Social Security check goes away. You do it second if the wife dies first in the same situation. So you want to see, under those different circumstances, if the person you leave behind is going to be okay. And this, I think, is just a primary duty, especially of a breadwinning spouse.
When it comes to the percentage you hold in stocks, you said that having read the research, you have come to think of retirement as being split in 2 halves. Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, I think when people retire, they all of a sudden your mind switches. When you're working, you're thinking, I just want to save more money. Maybe you have a number in mind, but basically you know you should be saving money for retirement. When you retire, your mind switches. Suddenly, you look at those savings and you say, I have to get an income stream out of this saving. How long am I going to make it last? And that's a whole different point of view on the money you have. And lots of people say, I've got to go to income investments. I should have bonds. I should have CDs. I'm now retired. The market isn't safe. But, you know, we were just talking about longevity. And when you retire at 60 or 65 or 70, you're going to live 20, 25, 30 more years. You are a long-term investor. You are not just a short-term investor that thinks about CDs. So I think about retirement investing as having, you know, bond funds and CDs and whatnot that sort of help you balance your investments and get through the first 5 or 10 years of your retirement. But, you know, you've got to have a lot of your money, you know, 50% maybe, invested in stock market for long-term growth, because the second half of your retirement is going to start, say, 15 years from now or 20 years from now even. And by then, the American economy will have grown, the global economy will have grown, business profits will have grown. And by being in stock, owning mutual funds, which is all I buy, I don't buy individual stocks, to being in funds, you are going to be hitched to the long-term growth of the global economy. And that is what's going to fund the second half of your retirement.
Email from Margaret Ann. She says, I would like to hear her opinion on conventional versus Roth IRAs. I tell my children to use Roth IRA if feasible. When we reach 71 plus, we must start taking distributions from both conventional IRAs and deferred compensation plans, 401ks, etc. These distributions increase every year and are then taxed as regular income. I find as I get older that they are a major hit to my taxes. If one has a family history of living a long time, the Roth IRA is a great advantage. And they're asking your opinion, Jane Bryant Quinn.
The answer is absolutely right. I tell my kids exactly the same thing. And with a Roth IRA, just quickly to say, mm-hmm. it's a retirement plan. You put money into it. There's no tax deduction for what you put in, but the money that is there will grow tax-free. You never have to take it out at 70 and a half if you don't need it. You can leave it to your kids tax-free. So once you put the money in, there it is. And there's a second thing that I just advised my niece to use a Roth IRA for college planning instead of the traditional 529. And this is, you're younger, you're making contributions into a Roth IRA, and those contributions don't have to stay there until you're 59 and a half or until you're 70. The contributions you yourself make can come out at any time, at any age, with no tax penalty. Now, you can't take out the earnings that have accumulated in your own contributions. That has to wait till you're at least 59 and a half. But the money you put in can be taken out. So I tell my niece, have a Roth IRA. You can use it when college comes. You can take out your own contributions for your kids. If they get scholarships, then you don't have to spend so much money. The Roth continues to grow. They can have it for their own retirement. It's a wonderful, flexible plan that you can use in many, many different ways. So I'm strongly in favor of Roth.
How much does flexibility play into this? Because that first 10 years after retirement, that's ideally, I guess, the most active. You know, you're still young, but the last 10 years, you don't really need the same amount of money, do you?
No, actually, it's very interesting. They found out that in general, when you look at what people spend in retirement, they tend to spend roughly what they spent before. Sometimes, obviously, if they've had serious problems. So this always accepts people who lose jobs early or become ill and have to go through their whatever savings they have. But if they have had, if you will, kind of a normal progression, they tend to spend actually less in retirement overall, spend a little more in their first 10 years, but not a lot more, and spend a little less in their last 20 years. I mean, I'm always looking at 30-year retirements. We celebrated my mother's 100th birthday this year, so I'm always
amazing.
Thinking very long term.
Right.
And people who I had a woman tell me the other day that she spends exactly the same amount of money. She's not spending less, but of course she's spending the same amount of money, but there's been inflation. So in real terms, she's spending less, but she doesn't realize it.
Mm-hmm.
She's just planned her budget for the way it goes. And that is a very common situation in retirement. But the thing is, Anne, you have to start with right-sizing your life,
mm-hmm.
getting those projected, spending and income numbers down in front of you, and then figuring out how much, if you need to take money out of savings to help pay your bills, how much you can afford to do that every year and have your money last for 30 years. I mean, and that's where the recipes come in, where the research is being done. And I spoke to all those researchers for my book, and it's all in there.
My guest is Jane Bryant Quinn, the, of course, celebrated personal finance journalist. Her new book is entitled How to Make Your Money Last, The Indispensable Retirement Guide. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Retirement can feel like a distant image, making it easy to put off financial planning until late in the game. At that point, instead of managing assets, though, you're managing stress. We're talking about retirement readiness, what you need to consider so that by the time you reach your golden years, they are in fact golden and the money lasts. Still with us is veteran financial journalist Jane Bryant Quinn. Her new book is entitled How to Make Your Money Last, The Indispensable Retirement Guide. And thanks again, Jane Bryant Quinn, for joining us today.
A pleasure, Ann. Thank you.
You said that while working on this book, you changed your mind about a few things, immediate pay annuities and reverse mortgages. What changed for you about those annuities, which is, of course, a form of insurance or, I guess, or investing that gives you an annual sum each year?
When I was doing the reporting and I was looking, I'm always looking at people in different financial situations. You know, when we're working and saving money and putting kids through college, basically we're all pretty much alike. You know, live on less than you earn, save as much as you can, you know, do Roth IRAs or something for college. When we retire, we're all in a different position, depending on how old we retired, how much you saved, how good your health is, how good your spouse's health is, whether or not you're afraid of stocks. So you have all these varieties of problems that have to be addressed, and there's not a big general rule of thumb anymore. So the immediate pay annuities really solve a certain kind of problem that I hadn't really focused on before. With these, and by the way, let me say, I am not talking about the deferred variable annuities with living benefits that financial advisors love to sell, and the fees come to 3.5 or 4% a year. I think that those are very poor investments, and I'm against them. But the immediate pay annuity is you a piece of money up front, give it to the insurance company, they'll pay you X dollars per year for life. And if you are someone who is just on Social Security and small savings, you don't want that because you need the flexibility of having your savings available. If you're really rich, you don't need an immediate annuity. But if you're somebody who says, you know, I think that the savings I have will probably last for 30 years, but I'm not sure. And if you are keeping part of that money in bond mutual funds to feel a little safer than with stocks, if you take part of that money that you've got in the bond funds and you switch it into an immediate pay annuity, you are going to get a higher lifetime income from that portion of money. And that might just plug the gap that you've been worried about. So when I started looking at the numbers and looking at the financial planners or talking to them who were using this device, I just used to kind of dismiss annuities, but I don't do it anymore. If you're in that particular situation, an immediate pay annuity is worth looking at.
And what changed your mind about reverse mortgages? First, tell us what a reverse mortgage is.
Yeah, the reverse mortgage is a loan against the equity you have in your home. And you don't have to pay the principal or interest on that loan as long as you stay in the home. So it gives you an extra source of income. You're tapping your home equity while you are living there, and it's not costing you anything out of pocket. When you leave the home because you die or you go in a nursing home or you decide to sell for whatever reason, then the loan comes due and all the principal and interest is paid to the lender, and if there's anything left over, it goes to you or to your heirs. Now, formerly, I was against them because they were usually taken by older people, 70s and 80s, mm-hmm. and then they would take a lump sum and run out of money, and then they couldn't pay the taxes and insurance on the house, and so the bank would foreclose. And so here you bought something that you thought was going to last as long as you were in the house, and suddenly you found that you couldn't keep the house after all. That was a terrible thing. Congress, about a year and a half ago, changed the rules so that that can't happen or shouldn't happen in older age now, because they look at your income, and if they think you're marginal, they take offsets. They just make sure that your taxes and insurance will be payable while you're in the house. So that risk is off the table. Now let's look at people who are, say, 62, which is the earliest age you can get it. if you got a reverse mortgage at 62 and took it in the form of a credit line, did not borrow against it except for your upfront costs, which are substantial. So that's all that goes on the credit line. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you never borrow against it, or you don't borrow against it for a while. That credit line increases every year by the interest rate that you, the internal interest rate that you are owing on that loan you have. So you have a rising credit line. And if you don't touch it for 10 years or 12 years, and it's something that is a great hedge against inflation. You say, oh, I'm running a little short. I spent more than I meant to. Now you go and look at this home equity credit line and you say, hey, I've got a much larger pot of money here that I could borrow from. And if you never borrow from it, that's fine too, because when you sell the house, what's left goes of the equity goes back to your heirs or yourself if you've sold the house.
So you're kind of converting that equity in your house into a better way to generate
income. A better way of generating income. Uh-huh. And if the market has gone down and you've had money in stocks and it scares you, you say, okay, I'm not going to take any money out of my stock savings this year. I'm going to take it out of my reverse mortgage credit line. So it just gives you more flexibility. You don't have to use it, but if you are using it, it's good. But I make this warning, you have to be someone who really wants to stay in your house for 15 or 20 years, because it is a substantial upfront fee, and that's the way to amortize the cost.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is financial journalist, personal finance journalist Jane Bryant Quinn. Her new book is entitled How to Make Your Money Last, The Indispensable Retirement Guide. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. Email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or your comment there. Philip in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Philip.
Hi, Ann. Thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I know that Ms. Quinn just recently said that she likes Roth IRAs. I'm 65. I plan to work about 5 more years. I have a pension and a decent amount in a 401k. If I'm still saving money and trying to save somewhat aggressively, should I be putting money into the 401k or into a Roth IRA?
Are you getting a company match on the 401k?
No match.
I would put it into a Roth IRA. Why not?
Well, because
sounds to me like a very useful, before you can withdraw your earnings, you have to have, if you want to withdraw the earnings, in fact, you have to have held the Roth for at least 5 years. Be over 59 and a half, which you are, or hold the Roth for at least 5 years.
Right, but I would have, say if I were going to put $1,000 away, I'd have only $700 that would go into the Roth IRA, but I'd have $1,000 that would go into the 401k to appreciate.
That's right, you would. And so then the question is, there was an earlier caller who discovered to her shock that because of the amount of money she had in her 401k and taking money out of other plans, that her taxes were much higher in retirement than she expected. And the amount that you have to take out of your 401k might push you into a higher bracket for Social Security, for your taxes that will be owed on Social Security income. So that's something that you need to take a look at. Whereas if the money is in a, yes, you miss the current tax deduction, but if the money is in the Roth, you're not going to run into that issue maybe of putting yourself into a higher Social Security tax bracket, and you don't have to take it out at 70 and a half if you don't want to. And that might be flexible for you.
Okay, Philip, thanks for that call. A lot of people are thinking differently about retirement these days. They aren't necessarily in love with the idea of idleness. How does that play into the issue of finances?
Our longevity, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, and this again is one of the things that I found when you asked me earlier about what I in reporting this book.
Yeah.
My first chapter is actually about an emotional plan for retirement. You need two plans. No, an emotional plan, which means when you're retired, you're going to live another 25 or 30 years, as we've said. What are you going to do with that period of your life? And you can, I think of it as when you get out of school, college or high school or whatever, and you don't know what's going to happen to you, and then eventually, life goes on and you find out what happens to you. When you leave the active workforce and your paycheck stops, then it's like being out of school again for the first time. What is going to happen to you? Mm-hmm. How are you going to reinvent your life? Who are you going to be? You're finally free, but free to do what? And some of us are working longer. The statistics show that, partly because we need the money, but partly because we really love it and we're active and we're there. Most people in this boomer generation, if their health is good, are certainly getting involved in other things. Maybe they're working part-time. Maybe they're not earning pay, but they're reinventing a whole new life for themselves. And you really need to do that. You can't sit and watch television for 30 years. You get really depressed. So this is a huge challenge. You need a financial plan for your next 30 years because that's your base. But you also need a living plan so you can transfer from the status of worker, reporter, journalist, teacher, whatever, to the status of engaged citizen, retired. That's a huge emotional jump, and it's a challenge for a lot of people.
And it really, it matters when it comes to finances.
It matters because how long you work, because you're going to live much longer. Probably you're going to live much longer than you think you're going to. And so working longer is a great idea because you have more savings. And by putting off taking Social Security, the longer you can put off taking Social Security, the higher your check is going to be for life. And that's a huge issue. And by the way, for anybody listening who shaking his or her head and saying, oh, no, Social Security won't be there when I retire, it will be there. No, any Congress that tried to get rid of Social Security would not be in office the following year, not one of them.
An email from Jan, and this goes right to what you and I were talking about before we went on the air, Jane Bryant-Quinn. She writes, since turning 62, I have been swamped with offers from financial planning groups to help me with retirement. Are these people legitimate, or are they similar to ambulance chasers wanting to spend my money?
Oh,
Where were they 30 years ago?
I love that, ambulance chasers.
Yeah.
Jan, you got it, ambulance chasers. People who are retiring who have a 401k or 403b or similar types of savings, you have a target on your back. Everybody has your name. Everybody knows that you just might be looking for financial advice. And believe you me, all the people who are reaching you by emailing you or snail mailing you, these are all people who have things they want to sell you and on which they will earn commissions. And the first thing they will want to sell you is this deferred variable annuity with living benefits, et cetera, I spoke to before. I sometimes laugh and say there are many financial advisors who lock the door and won't let you out of the office until you sign up for one of these things because they're very high commission. They're the most popular thing to sell to new retirees in particular. So I am a huge fan, as anyone who's read my other books and columns knows, of mutual funds, simple, low-cost mutual funds that follow the stock market as a whole or the bond market as a whole. They're called index funds, index bond funds, index stock funds. They have been the heart of my personal investing for 40 years. And that means that I have had a very, very good 40-year return. And I just encourage you to look into these simple forms of investment. And if you do take a financial advisor, take what they call a fee-only financial advisor. And that will be somebody who does not take commissions, sales commissions, for any product. Some people call themselves fee-based, and they say, oh, well, we just charge a fee, but by the way, on the other hand, we also sell products. You want an advisor who charges for his or her time or for the project or for managing your money, but does not sell you stuff, because the advisors who sell you stuff, and they are all the ones who are writing to you, They have their own interests very much at heart.
I imagine that Jan, among those offers from financial planning groups, gets a lot of those offers to go to different meetings, like they going to give you dinner out at a local restaurant, or some of them charge, you know, 40 or 50 or 60 or whatever dollars to go to a seminar and that kind of a thing. If you go to those kind of things, are they trying to sell you something?
Yes, of course. Mm-hmm. Always they're trying to sell you something. Mm-hmm. These are not charitable seminars. They might be selling, might be selling annuities. They might be selling some form of insurance. They might be selling trusts, a lot of living trusts, which are sold to people who don't need living trusts at seminars like this. All of them are inviting you to buy something when you're there. And so many people sort of go and say, well, I know all about that, but I'm just going for the free dinner. And then they wind up getting a little bit bedazzled and signing up for something before they leave, or just making an appointment with the advisor before mm-hmm. they leave, so they sign up later. I mean, if you can really just do the free dinner and go with your friends, I mean, free dinners are okay with me, but stop right there.
Okay. Paul in Columbus, you're on the air with Jane Bryant Quinn. Hi, Paul.
Hello.
Hi, Paul.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And my question for your guest is, I have a sister, retired, living in Florida, 74 years old. She recently came upon an insurance settlement for $65,000. And she was asking me for advice. And, you know, I've done some research on it. I'm retired myself. But I thought maybe, first off, pay off her condo, which has a mortgage of $22,000, I think, and then taking $20,000 and putting in a savings account, and then another $20,000 for an annuity. Now, I was wondering if your guests thought this would be a good idea for her, or what would be.
First, paying off the condo is a great idea. Not only does it save her money every month, but it, I'm sure, will give her more peace of mind because she knows she owns the place. Mm-hmm. I think $20,000 in savings is also a great idea because that gives her some flexibility. When you say annuity, what kind of annuity did you have in mind?
It would be a immediate annuity, and that would be to supplement her Social Security, which is basically all she has as an income right now.
Your sister is so lucky to have you looking out for her, because that is, I think, exactly what I would say and what we were talking about before.
Right.
She has the annuity. She has $20,000 flexible that she can do something with, and she's got Social Security, which is inflation-adjusted. Not that we've had much of inflation lately, but mm-hmm. if it goes up, it's inflation-adjusted. She will be in much better shape, and I thank you for being so helpful to her. That's just exactly the right thing to do.
Thank you, Paul, for that call. If you out there have a call or question or comment, you can give us a call too, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is financial journalist Jane Bryant Quinn. Her new book is entitled How to Make Your Money Last, The Indispensable Retirement Guide. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. They say it's never too early to start saving for retirement, but is it ever too late? Saving for the hoped-for healthy and active retirement years can feel overwhelming to some. There's a lot of ground to cover, 401ks, IRAs, estate planning, pensions, home equity, blah, blah, blah. Today, we're demystifying the retirement planning process with leading personal finance journalist and author of a new book, How to Make Your Money Last, The Indispensable Retirement Guide, Jane Bryant Quinn. Jane, thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure, Ann.
The question, how late is too late to begin thinking about retirement? Is it ever too late?
It's never too late. some people think if they're working at 60 or 62 and they plan to work longer and they've got a 401k or company plan of some sort, mm-hmm. and they say, know, there's really no point putting money in at this because I'm going to retire in 3 years or 5 years and I'd just be taking it out again. But the answer is no, no. You won't be taking it out in 3 years or 5 years. You are going to live another 30 years. So whatever you put in, even at 62 and invest for the future, is going to be stretched out over a long time period. So just keep on putting that money away, whether you choose a company plan or whether you choose a Roth, as we were talking before with one of the callers. It is never, ever too late.
I want to take a call from Sharon now in Westerville. She's going to ask about Social Security. I did a whole show on Social Security alone last year, Jane. Sharon in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Sharon.
Hi there. How are you doing, Ann?
Fine, thanks.
Hey, my question is I have a state of Ohio pensioner, will have when I go to retire, and as a result of that, I will be losing money on my Social Security when I get that full pension. And I know everybody says wait till you're older to collect your Social Security and wait till 70, you'll get more money. However, when they've done the calculation, I come out a lot less waiting. And so I just was trying to get a comment on those that have state pensions, how that impacts them, also that have the ability to collect Social Security, because I had my time in with them as well.
So that means because I pay into a state pension now too, Sharon, because I work for OSU, and I don't pay Social Security anymore.
Right, but
yeah.
I already have my 40 quarters
right.
in because I came to the ball game late.
Me too, yeah, okay. Jane Brown Quinn.
And so I'm just trying to say, so you have your 10 years in for Social Security, so you are expecting some Social Security.
Correct.
And so for you, the question is whether you should take it at 62 or whether you should wait until later.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out what is the break-even point to go ahead and start collecting it earlier since I'm going to lose it out at the other end.
Right. But you don't lose it at the other end. You lose it as you go along. Because you don't get as high a check, yes?
Right.
Right. So I guess I have only this to say about the so-called break-even point.
Mm-hmm.
Break even assumes that you are going to somehow make it either before or later a certain break even point that will make the amount that you put in or take out. I'm tripping over my tongue because my thoughts are running ahead. So that will the amount that you lose by delaying is you have to wait a certain number of years before you can then start taking it and making that up.
Mm-hmm.
Here is the thing. You don't know how long you're going to live. And we are all living longer lives, you know, as we were saying, especially people who are healthy and have had health insurance all their lives and have a good education, we're living even longer. And when people think about the break-even point, they're thinking, oh, dear, what if I died young and didn't collect as much as I otherwise could have because I put off taking Social Security? So by taking it early or worrying about the break-even point, you're worrying about maybe you'll die young. I think the bigger risk is that you will die at a time when maybe you might run out of money. You are going to live much longer than you think you're going to live. Those are the odds for you. So the question is, do you want to bet on dying younger or do you want to bet on living longer? And so don't look at those particular numbers because I don't think that they will help you. I think what will help you is thinking of whether you want to treat Social Security as longevity insurance, which is what it is, inflation-adjusted longevity insurance, or if you want to just worry about, I've been rooked if I put off taking it and I die young. This is an emotional choice, I know, but I think that's the way you need to look at it.
All right, Sharon, thanks a lot for that call. And Ed in Baltimore, you're on the air. Hi, Ed.
Hi. I'm getting ready to retire, and we have a disability income policy with an insurance company. It's been good because we've had a need to use it over the last couple of years. But in retirement, is it worth keeping a disability insurance policy?
I think I'm not sure that you can. You ought to check with your retirement plan about that, because disability is paid when you are unable to bring a paycheck in for one reason or another.
And if you're retired, the idea is you're not.
And if you're retired, you don't have a paycheck. So I'd take a look at your policy, and I'd call your insurance agent and direct that question to the agent.
Okay, thanks a lot, Ed. And then Karen in Dublin, I want to go to you because she brings up an issue that you do as well, Jane Bryant Quinn, in your book. Karen, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi. I have a question that my husband and I are retired, and we have planned fairly well, and we are fairly savvy about, you know, investment things, but we have read that options trading is a way to make additional income in retirement, and I want to know what your thoughts were about that.
Options trading, you can you can do a put, you can do a call, you can collect extra money on your stocks, and if you win your bet, you have extra money and you have the stocks. If you lose the bet, you have the extra money, but you don't get the stocks, you have to buy another stock. To me, that this is absolutely outside my field in terms of retirement investing. To me, this is part of playground. And I think that some people who are full-time options traders may make some extra money, but when you put, you have an option, and if the stock, you know, exceeds the price, you have to sell the stock, and so now you don't have the stock anymore. You have the money you collected for the option, and now you have to go around and buy another stock. And also, you're having to buy individual stocks, which is risky in itself, mm-hmm. as opposed to stock-owning mutual funds, which are more diversified. I mean, if you think you get a kick out of this kind of trading, I'm not going to say no. You know, but put aside a certain amount of money and see how it goes for you. But I wouldn't put too much money into it until you had a feel for how this actually worked and whether you were actually making money. And if you've done it for a year or two, whatever, with your limited pot of money, then compare it with what you would have had if you had kept those stocks and had not sold options against them, if you just ignored that extra income part and just held on to all the stocks.
Okay, sure. Karen, thanks a lot for that call. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Speaking of stocks, the Dow is down 10% below what it was last year. January 1st was the worst market since whenever. So as far as being anxious about the stock market, is that where you split sort of retirement in half when it comes to the stock market? Or
Yes, because mm-hmm. If you're retired, I believe in what I call bucket investing, mm-hmm. and you've got one bucket for your cash savings, say, help you pay your bills or feel sure that you know you can pay your bills for the next 2 years or 3 years, and then you have some money in bond, and I'm in favor of government bond funds, even though the interest rates are low. When stocks go down in price, government bond funds usually go up in price, which is very valuable if you need to take money out. And then you have some money for the long term in mutual funds. And look at the market. It goes down 10%. Maybe it's going to go down some more. It was terrible. 07, 08 went down almost 50%. Mm. Look at the history of the stock market in general. Not individual stocks, but because individual stocks can go to zero. But the stock market in general has always recovered and has always gone higher after it recovered. So if you're a long-term investor and you're saying, I'm 60, what am I going to have to live on when I'm 80 from my savings? You should just be ignoring these stock prices. You can't time it. You're not going to sell at the peak and then buy in at the bottom. How many people who got scared in 07 and 08, which was the scariest time of all, and then bought back in 09, which is when the stock market just started its huge surge up? You know, it just hasn't happened. So you need to have that long-term view of what the market is. And 1 week view or a 2 week view means that you're not set up right. You've got your savings that's going to help you pay your bills. You've got, say, government bond funds that if you need to take money out, that'll probably go up in price. And then you can just forget about the stocks until they recover. Over history, I had somebody do these numbers for me. In any stock market peak, from that peak to the bottom, back to the previous price, the average length of time it takes to recover your money over that period has been 29 months. And that's not a lot of time when you're talking about being a long-term investor. So these are issues that you just can't look at it this week. You have to say, am I okay if the market doesn't do well for the next year or two? And you should be okay. You're finances should be set up so you'll be okay. But you know, Anne, if you're someone who just cannot stand that, not for a second, you know, maybe you should say, all right, I am not going to live as well in retirement as I could if I invested for the long term and let my money grow. Because temperamentally, I can't stand it. In that case, you know, do bonds, do your CDs, do your, you know, quite right-sizing your life, cut your budget so that you can fit into a life that will do on Social Security and certificates of deposit. You know, there's nothing wrong with that if that's emotionally how you're going to feel. That's better than putting some money in stocks and then getting scared when they go down for a week and selling out.
Know thyself, right?
Know thyself. But fit your standard of living to what your income is going to be.
You said that if you have already retired and are spending more than 4% of your capital this year, that that's a trumpet call. What's the magic of 4%, and is that true right up until death?
Now, there's a sort of guideline for what rate you can take your money out of your savings and have it feel reasonably sure that it will last for 30 years, and even if there's a depression or a stagflation as there was in the 70s, early 80s, to be reasonably sure. And it starts with what they called the 4% rule. When you retire, you can and start drawing on the money, you can take 4% in that year, and then in each subsequent year, you take that same amount of money plus an increment for inflation so that you are keeping the income from your savings steady in real terms. Now, that is extremely conservative. If you are well diversified and have a small stock mutual fund as well as a large stock mutual fund, it could be 4.5% in that first year, plus inflation increments. If you are very flexible about your spending, so you could cut back in a year that the market does very badly, you could go to 5.5% in the first year you retire, plus inflation increments in subsequent years. That's what I meant when we were talking earlier, and I said there were recipes for the rate at which you could draw your savings out, depending on who you are. And these are the kinds of recipes that researchers have been working on.
As far as millennials go, we only have a few minutes left. It's not that I don't care about millennials. But they're facing a very different system coming up.
Well, they are actually, in general, they are saving a little more money because they see what happened to their parents or their grandparents, and they have worried about that. So, right now, the economy is growing, and the jobs, you know, the unemployment rate is down. And I think that at the moment, millennials are probably in reasonably good shape. Again, there are always people who cannot find jobs. And so I always want to put that in because you can't be too general about this. But the economy for millennials right now is okay. They're saving more money, and I think they're looking ahead.
Jane Bryant Quinn, thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate your time.
Always like it, Anne. Always like to talk to you.
Jane Bryant Quinn, author of How to Make Your Money Last, The Indispensable Retirement Guide. Thanks to everyone for your calls, for your questions and comments. And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.